go back to where you came from. President Trump has injected that phrase into the national dialogue this week, and that troubles this Latino Trump supporter.
When somebody says, you know, go back to where you came from, you know, it's not a good feeling.
But will that change his support for Trump? Also, growing outrage in Puerto Rico after leaked messages show the island's political leaders mocking the dead after Hurricane Maria.
Wow, we were dying. These people were laughing at us.
Plus, Brazil's first black transgender lawmaker knows that challenging racism and homophobia is dangerous, but she does it anyway.
I've never been afraid, just like anyone else like me. I know that I am vulnerable, and I choose to take protective measures, but not be afraid.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Send her back. President Trump said today he felt a little badly about that chant last night at his campaign rally. The racist and xenophobic refrain was targeted at Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. Omar had the support of London's mayor today and thousands of others who all signed a letter saying, quote, "We are disgusted by Donald Trump's attack on you. His blatant, unashamed racism has appalled people around the world." The paradox of Trump's America is that he does have supporters who are themselves immigrants and people of color. How does this week's ugliness look to them? We asked Art Gallegos Jr., co-founder of the Latinos Conservative Organization in Gainesville, Georgia.
It concerns me, it concerns friends, it concerns pastors, it concerns Latino business owners, Latino community. What both parties are saying, what the president has been saying, what these other congresswomen and the other party, Democratic Party, is establishing, trying to rattle up people to just focus on a certain item, on a certain word, on a certain sentence. It is concerning, but I am a true believer that the Latino base, the Latino Hispanic conservative base, will see the bigger picture.
Regardless of who started the current debate, isn't it the job of the top office holder in the land not to amplify the debate, but to unite people?
We did not elect a person that was in politics. I am not justifying the rhetoric that has been said. All I'm saying is that Congress, politicians, and the president hold a office that should be, number one, with integrity, with respect, and at the same time, to communicate what they're trying to say in a manner that they will not divide this country.
Well, Trump was certainly communicating last night. Let's take in some of the mood at that rally in North Carolina. That's the crowd chanting, "Send her back," in reference to Representative Ilhan Omar. Art Gallegos, your father and mother were born in Mexico and emigrated to San Diego in the 1970s. How does talk about sending people back sit with you?
Of course, it doesn't sit well. I think that I would be not true to myself to say that when somebody says, you know, go back to where you came from, you know, it's not a good feeling, you know, especially when you are not originally up for this country.
Has anyone ever said that sort of thing to you?
You know, I've been fortunate not to, but I have experienced discrimination. But again, there's got to be work on both sides. Everyone needs to stop this rhetoric and focus on what we really need to accomplish.
So your job, Art, is to reach out to Latino voters who might lean conservative. President Trump has decided to take on these four lawmakers of color, including one with Latin roots. Has this made your job harder?
It makes my job harder, you know, harder, not impossible, because I have sat down with many folks that are Latino, Hispanics. And you know what? I've seen people that say, you know what? I disagree with what he says. But you know what? I agree with the way the nation is heading and where it's at.
Would you describe your own support for President Trump in 2020 as unconditional? Or is there a line when talking about race or sending immigrants back to where they came from that if he crosses it, he loses your backing?
Yes, there is a line. I think we all have that line where people shouldn't cross. He's very close, at least me personally. You know, he's very close.
What is the line that if Donald Trump were to cross it, he would lose your support?
You know, you have to stand up for your rights. You have to stand up for people that are ignorant. I've experienced racism directly. Went back. Why don't you go back to Mexico?
So you have heard that.
Yes. And we live in a world that people will say things without even thinking. We hear in our community, we hear it in our schools, we hear it in our workforce. These are things that are not very good to hear, but it is a reality of life.
Art Gallegos Jr., the co-founder of the Latinos Conservative Organization, speaking with us from Gainesville, Georgia. Thanks very much for your time and for your thoughts, Art.
Thank you very much for having me.
Trump's election in 2016 sparked a political reaction. A lot of young, diverse candidates were motivated to run for office. That same pattern emerged in Brazil, where the election of a right-wing president has also pushed new people into politics. Both Brazil and the U.S. share some relevant background here. Both are former European colonies with a history of slavery. The World's Rupa Shenoy introduces us to one of Brazil's groundbreaking diverse leaders.
A few months ago, on the floor of the Sao Paulo state legislature, a politician said if he found a transgender person in the same bathroom as his mother or sister, he would, quote, shove him in the toilet and call the police. Maybe someone said something like that before. But now there's a fellow lawmaker to respond. Erica Maluginho steps to the mic.
Eu faço pedido.
She's 37, tall, with long hair, and points a finger to emphasize.
Porque você falar que você é deputado eleito, você está pela... por mais de uma vez...
Maluginho's calling what the previous speaker said hate speech. She's demanding an investigation, saying that comments like that are homophobic and incite violence. That was Maluginho's first month on the job as the first Afro-Brazilian transgender lawmaker in one of the deadliest countries in the world for transgender people.
I've never been afraid, just like anyone else like me. I know that I am vulnerable, and I choose to take protective measures, but not be afraid.
Because just by being in office, Maluginho says she's a rebuke to Brazil's history of oppression.
We have a history that we carry that makes us be present. This gigantic problem that was created when blacks left Africa on slave ships.
Okay, some history. Brazil received nearly 20 times as many enslaved Africans as what would become the U.S. did. In Brazil, they did brutal work growing sugar or mining gold. And many Africans ran away to create communities called quilombos. Marcio Farias is at the Museu Afro-Brasil in Sao Paulo.
Quilombos were the main expression of the political fight of those who were enslaved.
Farias says quilombos inspired constant rebellions. Brazil's government finally abolished slavery in 1888. Newly freed people weren't compensated, and many had nothing for generations. Farias says that finally began to change when Brazil became a full democracy in 1988.
The process of becoming a democracy created social movements. Those social movements demanded affirmative action, and that has changed the face of the country.
The new affirmative action programs meant more Brazilians had access to jobs and education. Erica Maluginho's mother was able to go to school and become a nurse. Maluginho grew up in a politically active family.
I learned how to deal with my existence as a black person when I was little. Our families taught us, never go out without your ID. Don't wear certain clothes. That's taught to all black children.
It was a formative experience when Maluginho saw transgender people dancing Aramaracatu, a traditional carnival procession that symbolizes an African king and queen leading a full court in flamboyant clothing.
That's where, for the first time, I saw the first transvestite woman being out in the open.
Maluginho moved to Sao Paulo and became an activist, artist, and educator. For a brief moment, it seemed like an era of positive expression about inclusion in Brazil. In the 2010 census, for the first time, a majority of Brazilians self-identified as non-white. Around this time, Maluginho created a space in Sao Paulo that she called an urban quilombo, an urban community for Afro-Brazilians to meet and share their politics and culture with things like music and art. Early last year, Maluginho was featured on a TV program talking about it. She said, even though black Brazilians can get jobs and go to school now, they are still considered others in traditional places of power.
We have no freedom in those places. We assume a confrontational position, which is exhausting. Sometimes I'm just not in the mood. I just want to be okay and at peace with my friends.
But then something happened that convinced many Brazilians to confront those in power in a way they hadn't before. Marielle Franco was murdered. She was an Afro-Brazilian from a favela, a poor neighborhood in Rio, who rose to be a city councilor. Franco was gay, feminist, and outspoken about police brutality. On March 14, 2018, after giving a speech, Franco and her driver were fatally shot. People were shocked. Franco's name became a rallying cry for a growing Black Lives movement. Just as Jair Bolsonaro was becoming a serious candidate for Brazilian president. Bolsonaro had already alienated a lot of people with his comments. He once said he was proud to be homophobic. Another time he said he'd rather have a dead son than a gay one. He's also said Brazil should not feel guilty about its past as the world's biggest slave importer. Erica Malugino decided she had to run for office.
The truth is that I live for prosperity and affection and positive things. So as long as those things are not guaranteed for everyone, I cannot not fight.
Meanwhile, Bolsonaro campaigned on the promise of a colorblind meritocracy, says Guilherme Casarrenx, a lecturer at the Sao Paulo School of Business. He says Bolsonaro considers things like affirmative action programs racist.
So he basically says that as long as he treats blacks and whites as equal, he wouldn't be a racist. But he turns a blind eye to pretty much every single problem that blacks go through.
Black Brazilians earn much less than whites. Nearly two-thirds of the country's unemployed are black. Three-fourths of murder victims are black. And human rights groups have criticized Brazil for police brutality and racial profiling of young black people. Despite all that, people of all backgrounds voted for Bolsonaro, Casarrenx says, because fear of violence is so widespread.
He said, vote for me and I'll do away with crime, but I'm also going to restore the real Brazilian values, which are the conservative religious values. Obviously, it has a lot to do with LGBT rights and women's rights and so on and so forth.
As president, Bolsonaro has attempted to roll back support for LGBTQ rights and quilombos. And Erica Malugino, in many ways, has become a successor to Marielle Franco as a symbol for the fight for human rights. This June, Sao Paulo's Pride Parade was one of the world's largest ever. Malugino spoke to the crowds while standing in a float.
We're always resisting and reacting. Resisting is great, but it hurts.
She told them they had to work together to go on the offensive. But it's tough to sustain momentum. Malugino says she does a dance between hope and logic. So when the Sao Paulo legislature apologized for the member who said he would shove a transgender person in a toilet, Malugino thanked her colleagues and said apologies weren't enough. They needed to vote to protect transgender people. That hasn't happened yet. But Malugino believes success is inevitable. She says this fascist wave won't last forever because most Brazilians understand the only possible future for the country is coexistence. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Sao Paulo, Brazil.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The United States is taking a stand against Myanmar's military for persecuting Rohingya Muslims. The State Department announced new sanctions this week.
We designated these individuals based on credible information of these commanders' involvement in gross violations of human rights committed by forces under their command.
The United Nations has called the atrocities against the Rohingya a genocide. The U.S. now boasts that it is the first government to take action against the army leaders who committed that violence. We've got the world's Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, with us to break down what this really means. So who was hit with these sanctions and why?
Four of Myanmar's top military generals, and these are men who masterminded and executed one of the worst atrocities in this century. So that's genocidal ethnic cleansing against this minority group, the Rohingya. And they live in this coastal area on the Bay of Bengal. So the army went in over the last 2 years and drove out more than 1 million Rohingya into the country next door, which is Bangladesh. And they did this through burning villages and murdering civilians. And then something I've personally documented, which is the army going in and using rape as a weapon of war or a tactic of war to spread terror so that people would flee. So when you think of war crimes, I mean, this is about as bad as it gets.
So what can you tell us about the most senior person who's been sanctioned here? How well known is he in Myanmar and how deeply connected is he to these atrocities?
Oh, everyone knows him in Myanmar. He's the most powerful person in Myanmar. His name is Min Aung Hlaing, General Min Aung Hlaing. When you think of abuses in Myanmar from the army, you should think of this man. He's the leader of the army, and he has so much more power than Aung San Suu Kyi, who's the most famous person to ever come from the country.
Any reaction from Myanmar's army or civilian leaders like Aung San Suu Kyi on these sanctions?
Well, the generals responded through a spokesperson, and they said this isn't going to affect us. This is an insult to our dignity, but that's it. And they're right. They won't be affected by this at all. The sanctions really are just a travel ban. So that means that these four guys can't come to the United States. So it's kind of a joke. They can't come to Disney World. They can't come see a play on Broadway. They can't send their sons and daughters to university in the U.S. And as far as I know, they weren't in the habit of coming to the U.S. anyway.
What is the point of these sanctions if they won't change anything? Who stands to gain from this?
I think the winner here is China. The ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya will still continue, so they don't really benefit from this. There are all sorts of raging civil wars in other parts of the country that will continue along the coast, up in the mountains of the country. China is the winner because it puts further distance between Myanmar and the number one superpower, which is the U.S., which means number two, China. Myanmar has to cling more tightly to China, and they already do for jobs and for aid and for weapons, for everything.
I mean, you say the ethnic cleansing will continue. It's been going on for a while, we should say, for several years, easily since the Obama administration. So why are these sanctions happening now?
Well, the UN has become more feisty in pushing for retaliation against the military. And so perhaps the U.S. is trying to follow up on that. There's a UN fact-finding mission that has called for very serious punishments, you know, financially isolating the entire military, bringing in generals for war crimes, and they've become more vocal in recent weeks. The UN doesn't use the word genocide lightly, and they're using it. That's a legal term, according to the UN, and it means certain legal mechanisms are triggered that can involve people being in the docket at The Hague. So perhaps the State Department wants to get out in front and do something, even though the something they're doing certainly won't change anything.
I mean, what other tools are there to stop the genocide?
Actual sanctions, the United States could really financially isolate not just the military, but the entire country. But we've been down that road before. There were sanctions from the U.S. against Myanmar for decades before Obama came in and lifted them. So that was a feel-good story, and there really was a lot to gain from that. The country really did open up. I spent time in Myanmar as the transition was happening, and in the early days, there were some shackles on life in Myanmar that were akin to North Korea. You know, it was very hard to even communicate without being spied upon. So U.S. coming in, lifting sanctions, that was a good news story. So maybe we're headed back that direction. I'm not sure.
The World's Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen. Thanks very much for your time today, Patrick.
Thanks, Marco.
A group of orphaned and rescued chimpanzees have found a safe home at an animal sanctuary in central Kenya. The number of wild chimps is decreasing thanks to hunting and habitat loss. Sweetwater's sanctuary is a refuge for 30 chimps, many of them injured in the illegal wildlife trade. The BBC's Anthony Irungu reports from Nanyuki, Kenya.
Timothy Mwangi leads us towards a rusty barbed wire fence, the only barrier between us and about 10 chimpanzees groaning at the edge of a nearby river.
By the time they arrive here, we get somewhere in a bad condition. People are living with them as a pets when they were young, but when they grown up, they become very strong and aggressive. So they end up either being caged somewhere or chained. So you could see them traumatized, but when they arrive here, we do integration with them. You see them, they are very happy, they are doing well compared to where they were living.
It's now midday and meal time is fast approaching. Behind the crowd, one chimpanzee is running out of patience. His name is Poco. He is 38 years old and is originally from Burundi. Unlike the other chimpanzees, he walks upright on 2 feet. Poco's story is perhaps the most tragic.
Poco used to live in a tiny, narrow cage whereby he could only sit and stand for 9 years. So you might see Poco walking on 2 legs, which is not normal for a chimpanzee to walk on 2, because he still remembers how he was living in a tiny, narrow cage.
Thanks to this sanctuary, Poco and the other refugee chimpanzees can now rebuild their lives. Sweetwater's chief executive officer, Richard Vine, explains how this rescue center came to be.
Chimpanzee Sanctuary was set up to accommodate young chimpanzees orphaned as a result of the bushmeat trade in West and Central Africa. Often in transit, those orphaned chimpanzees would be intercepted by customs officials as they were travelling. And as a result of that, a sanctuary movement developed across Africa to afford those young chimpanzees a safe and secure refuge for the rest of their lives.
The cost of maintaining one chimpanzee here in terms of food and medication is estimated to be over $4,000 per year. Given that Kenya is not a native for chimpanzees, there has been occasional interest from governments to have the chimpanzees repatriated to where they came.
There is an understanding that these chimpanzees now have been established here as a colony for many years, and to remove them and split apart their groups would be inhumane. So the chances of it happening are small.
For now, Richard and his team continue to provide care for refugee chimpanzees with the hope that their effort, increased awareness, and tougher policies will bring an end to illegal trafficking of chimpanzees.
Some rowdy and, I'm guessing, happy chimps ending that story there by the BBC's Anthony Irungu in Kenya. The Ebola outbreak in Congo is now a global health emergency, and the people on the front lines fighting the disease are worried.
We are extremely concerned by the fact that it has been 1 year now that this outbreak has been ongoing and that the transmission seems to be continuing unabated.
I'm Marco Werman. That story's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. A global health emergency, that's what the World Health Organization is now calling the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The virus has taken more than 1,600 lives since last year. And then this week, Ebola was confirmed in a major city, and that's raising alarms. Goma has nearly 2 million people, and it's also a major transportation hub. Tariq Riebel directs Ebola response in Goma with the International Rescue Committee.
I think the wider population has been very worried. We're seeing people really reacting very strongly to this. Despite the fact that we're almost at the 1 year anniversary of the outbreak, the epicenters have been very far away from Goma in the northern part of the province of North Kivu. And we do think that many people in the population have possibly been a bit too sanguine, a bit too relaxed about the situation overall. For us working on the response, however, this has always been an inevitability. And in some ways, we've been surprised that there haven't been more cases over time. Pleasantly surprised, of course, given the movement of population between the epicenters in the north and Goma.
So what does this declaration of a global health emergency actually mean? Is it a global threat?
We don't think that it's a global threat at this point. We have seen only 3 cases cross the border to Uganda. They were part of the same family, and that was rapidly contained and didn't lead to any transmission in that country. But we are extremely concerned by the fact that it has been 1 year now that this outbreak has been ongoing with consistent numbers and that the transmission seems to be continuing unabated.
So when it comes to containing the Ebola virus and this continued risk of it moving across international borders, what does declaring the outbreak a global health emergency in the DRC actually do?
Well, for one, we hope that on the positive side that it will increase the level of attention to this crisis. Many people have probably not even been aware that this is already the second biggest Ebola outbreak of all time. And we hope that donors will respond by supporting the response on the ground with additional means. However, on a slightly more negative note, we are concerned that some governments may react in an alarmist fashion. And we would hope that there wouldn't be any travel restrictions imposed on Congo. We're concerned that that could impact the response in terms of the movement of healthcare workers and medical supplies. And furthermore, that for Congolese people that are moving across borders, that if they're prevented or they're restricted from moving, that they might seek more clandestine measures that would make contact tracing much more difficult.
As you say, Tariq, the outbreak has been growing since last August. Why wait till now to declare it an emergency?
Well, I do think that when we look at the transmission, as I mentioned, besides the three cases that have crossed into Uganda, we have not seen an international case. And even the cases in Uganda were very clearly cases that came out of known epicenters and, in fact, even known contacts, so that they were very much Congolese cases. So in that sense, it hasn't had that international dimension. We saw, for example, in West Africa, where we had three countries with active transmission over a very long period. And then, of course, cases going into other countries, not just neighboring, but on different continents as well. We have not seen that in this outbreak. So that international dimension has been lesser.
The hope, as you said, is that more resources will come into play with the declaration of a global health emergency for this Ebola outbreak. But is that also kind of the point of declaring this emergency, to get more funding?
Absolutely. I think that's probably one of the key positive impacts of the declaration. I don't think anyone would have thought this was going to go on for this long. So in that sense, it's very different to other outbreaks of Ebola, which usually have been very short, usually 3 months or thereabouts. So this already is a completely different animal compared to those, and therefore continued attention is needed to bring this to an end.
We've spoken here on The World with a doctor on the ground in Beni, one of the hotspots of this outbreak, and he says they have the drugs, they have the capacity to treat people, but mistrust and militia violence mean that people are hesitant to seek help, and that lessens their chance of survival, of course, and increases the chances of Ebola spreading. Will this declaration do anything to ease those challenges?
Indirectly, they may cause some of the attention to shift. On the medical side, as the colleague stated, we have everything we need in terms of treatments and vaccines. I think where we need improvement is on the community side. We need to be able to win the trust of communities by communicating clearly with them, by being able to collaborate and work with them together, and being able to do a better job of outreach. I think that's the key aspect that all of us are trying to improve on in this response, and that ultimately will bring this to an end.
Tariq Riebel with the International Rescue Committee speaking with us from Goma, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you.
Next Wednesday, Britain will have a new prime minister. Only 160,000 Brits will decide on who that'll be. That's because the vote is restricted to members of the ruling Conservative Party. They're choosing a new party leader who will automatically become prime minister, replacing Theresa May. The key issue is Brexit and this question: which of the two candidates has persuaded party members that he will oversee a successful withdrawal from the European Union? From London, The World's Orla Barry reports.
Former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson has long been the bookmaker's favourite to move into 10 Downing Street. His competitor and current Foreign Secretary is Jeremy Hunt. The two couldn't be more different. Hunt, the experienced politician, self-controlled, a safe pair of hands.
First of all, I offer the calm, determined leadership that has always and will always make our country great.
Then there's Johnson with his mop of blonde hair, flamboyant, somewhat eccentric, and with a self-deprecating sense of humour. Here he is making one of his frequent TV appearances on a popular comedy news show.
The presenters' hairstyles were weird. Well, I can't see the problem there myself.
Both candidates attended elite private schools and Oxford University. While Hunt went to Japan to teach English, Johnson embarked on a checkered career in journalism. His first job was with the London Times. It was also the first time Johnson was fired for making up a quote. The Daily Telegraph newspaper then recruited him as their Brussels correspondent. And this is when his anti-EU sentiment truly came to the fore. He ridiculed the institution's layers of bureaucracy and often misrepresented its policies. The EU has designated snails as fish, he wrote. Another time he pronounced that Europe was contemplating a one-size-fits-all condom. Johnson's writing sometimes led him into serious hot water. He was forced to apologise to the people of Liverpool after an editorial he oversaw suggested the city wallowed in victimhood. The timing was terrible. Liverpudlian Ken Bigley had just been beheaded by hostage takers in Iraq. His brother Paul Bigley confronted Johnson on a local radio show.
You're a self-centred, pompous twit. Even your body language on television is so pathetic. You just don't even look right, never mind act right.
But Johnson survived, as he has many other controversial moments. It was his two terms as Mayor of London that cemented his popularity among Conservatives.
Declare Boris Johnson to be elected as the next Mayor of London.
That was his longest continuous period of public office, and hosting the London 2012 Olympics was a career highlight. Here he is at the Olympic torch relay party, hours before the Games opening ceremony.
Can we put on the greatest Olympic Games that has ever been held?
For many Londoners, his term will be most remembered for a bike share programme, which was in fact initiated by the previous mayor. Also a garden bridge across the River Thames that never materialised, and the cable car that Johnson promoted by buckling up himself and ziplining across the route before famously getting stuck midway.
Get me a ladder!
Johnson's colourful private life has also threatened to derail his political ambitions. Most recently, it made front page headlines when police were called to a domestic disturbance at the home of his girlfriend. Johnson has refused to make any comment. Jeremy Hunt, in comparison, has had a quieter path into politics. He quickly rose through the ranks, first becoming Health Secretary and then Foreign Secretary. His political career has been almost completely gaffe-free. Hunt's most memorable slip-up was in front of a room full of Chinese leaders when he momentarily forgot his wife's nationality.
Also, my wife is Japanese. My wife is Chinese, sorry. That was a mistake to make.
For both contenders, the greatest challenge will be Brexit. Hunt's critics say he can't be trusted to deliver it because he voted for Britain to stay in the EU. Now he says he's determined to take the country out of Europe. Johnson says under his premiership, Brexit will happen by the deadline of October 31st, come what may. And in terms of relations with the US, well, both men have been cautious in their condemnation of President Trump's recent tweets, telling four Democratic congresswomen to go back to where they came from.
I think it was totally unacceptable in a modern, multiracial country.
Why wouldn't you condemn it as racist then?
Well, you can take from what I've said what I think about President Trump's words.
Mr. Hunt, was it racist, Mark?
I think that, look, I'm Foreign Secretary. This is the president of a country which happens to be our closest ally. And so it is not going to help the situation to use that kind of language about the president of the United States.
With the TV debates over, Conservative Party members are making their choice. And all predictions are that Alexander Boris de Pfeffel Johnson will be the country's new prime minister next week. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
A lot of pomp and ceremony in Paris this past weekend for Bastille Day, when France celebrates its red, white and blue. A regiment of cavalry trots past the presidential reviewing stand as part of the Grand Parade, a reminder of the days of horse and musket when France was one of the world's greatest powers. But while most eyes were on the historical parades and fireworks, French President Emmanuel Macron made an announcement about the future.
Un grand commandement de l'espace sera créé en septembre prochain.
France is setting up a space force. Hereafter, the French Air Force will be known as the Space and Air Force. Chris Daugherty has extensive experience working on U.S. strategy at the Pentagon and, in fact, helped write the U.S. National Defense Strategy of 2018. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. So why is space important to the militaries of the world in 2019, Chris?
Space is critical for every aspect of military operations, everything from communications to shared position, navigation, and timing, what we use GPS for on our phones, imaging, reconnaissance, and things as banal as weather, which the United States military relies on to understand weather patterns, much like we do in our everyday lives.
So space defense implies a potential for combat. What would combat in space look like?
Combat in space could look like a number of things. I think it really depends on the scenario that you're thinking about. I actually tend to think that combat in space is likely to be largely non-kinetic. And what I mean by that is it's likely to use things like electromagnetic interference, what we call in the military electronic warfare or jamming, or use of lasers to dazzle sensors or even potentially burn them out. I think it's increasingly unlikely or hopeful, at least on my part, that people would use what we call kinetic weapons, that is to say, missiles to shoot other satellites out of space, in large part because of the danger of creating a lot of orbital debris and the repercussions of that.
I mean, still, you're a former Army Ranger yourself, so how sci-fi does this whole potential space force seem to you?
It actually seems eminently reasonable given the evolution of space technologies. A lot of people talk about the weaponization of space and how we haven't really seen it yet, and I would argue that's a bit of a short-sighted way of thinking about it. Space got weaponized the instant we put satellites into orbit to do things like look over the Soviet Union or communicate around the world. As soon as a military uses a domain or an area for something that is critical to our operations, you're inherently weaponizing it because the adversary or potential adversary is going to look at ways to take that away from you. What we haven't yet seen is combat between two spacefaring nations. But I think the worry on behalf of the United States, who's also standing up a Space Corps, and the French, who are now doing this, is that as more and more states get into space and become spacefaring nations, the likelihood of conflict and combat in space is going to go up. And at the same time, the amount that we rely on space, I was reading an article, and they said they estimated about 10 times a day every person in France interacts with a satellite. And I think that's probably only going to go up as we see more and more satellites in orbit. So the thinking is you have to have some sort of means to defend these assets. And I don't think that's sci-fi at all. I think that's here today.
I get why Washington, as a superpower, sees this as part of American military might. Why would a mid-sized nation like France need a space force?
I think what you're seeing is sort of a broader trend of what one might call the democratization of space as it becomes cheaper and more affordable for a wide range of states and even commercial entities to access space through things like SpaceX and Blue Origin and all these other firms that are coming with new launch technologies and also changing in space technology itself as satellites get smaller and more capable, even sort of at the low end. But for a country like France, I think, which has long seen itself as having a strategic imperative toward being part of NATO and being allied with the United States, but also having this Gaullist tradition of sort of strategic autonomy from the United States, I think they see a great deal of value in being the leader among a European space consortium, if you will, particularly in both commercial and in the defense realm, that allows them a degree of autonomy in how they operate in space, not relying wholly on the United States to do space defense for them.
Chris Daugherty, former Pentagon strategist, now a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Chris, thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Police broke up protests last night in Puerto Rico with tear gas and rubber bullets. Tens of thousands of people had marched from the Capitol building to the governor's mansion. And when police broke up the demonstration, thousands of protesters on motorcycles entered the scene. Protesters plan to be out again this evening for a sixth day of demonstrations and demands that Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rosselló, step down. The protest began when a group chat between Governor Rosselló and his top aides was leaked. Puerto Rico's Center of Investigative Journalism published nearly 900 pages of those conversations, and Puerto Ricans are angry about what that reporting revealed. Writer Ruben Ramos Colon was at last night's protest when the motorcyclists arrived.
They said that they were doing a rally in Storm San Juan with their motorcycles. We awaited, and they were detained by the police on the main bridge that connects the mainland with the island of Old San Juan. What we saw was a caravan of, I would say, at least 2,000, 3,000 motorcycles, just like a huge, long snake of light that would flood the whole length of the street. You could not see the end of the line of motorcycles advancing to San Juan. It was actually kind of surreal.
What exactly was so provocative in that leaked group chat that has brought people to this level of anger?
I think that in the 900 pages of the group chat, there was not a singular group of people in Puerto Rico that was not mentioned, offended, and just right out insulted by the information, from body shaming to homophobia. The comments, they had a different insult for each different group in the country. From religious groups, they mocked the people that they actually, I think that's the thing that we need to understand, that they mocked people that actually work for them and that are their followers. you just have this impression that you're seeing into the world of this group of bullies, like cartoonish bullies that are just gathering around, and instead of making the correct decisions, they're just playing around with people's lives. They mocked the deaths from the hurricane. I just think that it's just a general sense of disregard for human life and for the well-being of the people that has really resonated with everybody in the island.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the most troubling things about this. The leaked text messages have angered protesters, even included jokes about victims from Hurricane Maria. Yeah, you took the time, Ruben, to speak with us back then. It was really intense. Your mother had died of a bacterial infection. Truly heartbreaking story that I'm sure you relive every day. Do you see a line connecting the aftermath of the hurricane back in 2017 to these current protests?
No, definitely. I think that in the midst of the worst emergency we've had, they were just playing around with contracts and facilitating the access to those contracts to people from their party. And it seems like the conclusion of what started with the hurricane. I think that people really suffered in the hurricane. I'm not just talking about me. I think that 4,000 plus people died in the island. Every family was touched in a way by this hurricane. We were left out to die, literally on the streets. And now we find out that while we were dying and while we were making funeral arrangements for our people, these people were laughing at us and laughing at the deaths of our families. And I think that just struck a nerve.
So that long line of motorcycles in San Juan, why was that so surprising?
I think that we had lost hope in a sense. I don't want to say it like that because I love my people, but I think that we didn't trust ourselves anymore in organizing and actually doing something. And seeing those lights and seeing the people on the streets, it honestly gives us hope that our efforts won't be lost to the fires and to the general image of disarray, but that we're doing something to better our lives and that we are able to actually escape from what has been tormenting us for so many years.
Ruben Ramos Colon is a graduate student in linguistics at the University of Puerto Rico. He's been attending the demonstrations in San Juan. Ruben, thank you for your time, for talking with us today.
Thank you, guys.
Finally today, the musicians known as Ewa. They're three sisters in Israel, and on their new album, they pay tribute to a family member three generations back from Yemen. We'll let Tahir Haim tell us more about her family and music.
I formed this band with my two sisters, Liron and Tagel, about 5 years ago. I currently live in Tel Aviv, but we all grew up in a small desert village in southern Israel called Shacharut. Our grandparents immigrated from Yemen to Israel, so Yemenite culture has always been one of our biggest inspirations, and we sing in the Yemenite Arabic dialect. Our new album, Baiti Firasi, translates into My Home is in My Head, and it is a concept album inspired by the story of our great-grandma's journey from Yemen to Israel. She was a very strong and wise woman in a constant search of a home and for better luck in life, and although we didn't know her in person, we feel like we've gotten to know her and understand her through the process of writing our new album. The title track, Baiti Firasi, is based on a statement that Rachel, our great-grandma, used to say whenever she was asked why she's traveling from one place to another in Yemen. Her reply was, "I can't stay in one place. My home is in my head." Musically, we wanted it to be a Yemenite marsh, like a strong mantra that concludes the themes on the album that deal with the notions of home and the status of women in society.
That was Tahir Haim of the trio Ewa. Their new album, a tribute to their grandmother Rachel, is called Beti Firasi. Wow, what a groove. Our theme music was composed by Ned Porter. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Tomorrow's Friday. We'll see you then.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.